Testing 1, 2.
Oh, that worked.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out to Views and Brews this evening. I'm Rebecca. What do you need, Case? Move forward. Is that better? Okay. I'm Rebecca McEnroe with KUT, and this is a very special night because we have two guest hosts, and we're talking about something which is a little timely. So. First time for everything, right? Before we get started, I'd like to thank a few people for making Views and Brews possible. First off, our bartenders, Travis Grimmie and Mike Naylor. We couldn't do it without you, baby. Be sure to tip your bartenders. And we've got Casey Cheek running sound tonight. Thank you very much, Casey. Also from the Cactus Cafe and KUT, Matt Munoz, Amy Chambliss, and Hawk Mendenhall work very hard to bring you great programming here at the Cactus, and we thank you very much. Yeah. Views and Brews is on Facebook, so if you're on Facebook, please like us. We'll feel validated and wonderful and give you some great content in exchange. Also, let's see, what else? Oh, we are donation-based, like most of public radio. And so if you'd like to give us our money when you leave or when you come in, we'll gladly take it and we'll bring you more Views and Brews in the future. Our next Views and Brews is Tuesday, October 29th, and we'll be doing one on the psychology of fear with Art Markman and Bob Duke. So come out and join us for that. And in the meantime, email us at viewsandbrews@kut.org if you have any questions, comments, or anything at all. So with no further ado, I'm going to hand it over to two people who've been working really hard the past few months to bring you information on the Affordable Health Care Act and Obamacare and all the intricacies of this. First of all, Ben Philpott, welcome.
Howdy, thank you.
Well, one of the two of us have been working really hard to bring you information. Veronica Zaragovia from KUT has been working to bring you information on the ACA at KUT. I just get to kind of ask some questions tonight. Thanks for coming out again. And as Rebecca was saying, you know, you usually do ask for donations, as she asked tonight. Also, this is a beer-based economy tonight. The Cactus is able to do well. It works on healthcare and does data apps for the Texas Tribune and has been doing plenty of coverage also on the ACA launching and all the coverage of, as Veronica as well, the coverage of Medicaid expansion and everything during the legislative session. Bea Moorhead is the executive director of Texas Impact, which is a grassroots political activist religious organization. Is that right? Did I get them all in there? Okay. And then Elizabeth Colvin is director of Insure Central Texas, and a groupie in the back, all right, which is a program by Foundation Communities, which is a nonprofit focused on providing affordable homes and support services to low-income families and individuals here in Austin. So, you know, one thing that I will say about tonight, we really didn't want to rehash the debate over whether or not we should have the ACA, whether or not we should have Obamacare. The federal government's doing either a really good job or a really crappy job of that right now, so we'll just leave that to them. Tonight it was about getting information out, continuing to get information about what these exchanges that are now open could do to Central Texas, could do for Central Texans. So with that in mind, if you were here to have an angry debate about it, sorry, this isn't the right forum for that. But first of all, well, speaking of anger, why don't we start with Mark? Mark is a freelancer, so he is paying for his own private insurance, which you said is, do you mind saying how much the premium is a month?
No, I've got a family of five of us. I've got three young kids and a wife, and we're paying about $460 a month on the open market right now.
And you were saying that it doesn't appear to be a very robust plan because one of your children broke a collarbone, and you essentially paid for everything.
Yeah, we've been under this insurance for about a year, I figure, and they haven't paid for a thing yet. So they've got a lot of money, and we're paying for checkups and preventative care, pretty much every single thing. Worst part about it is you call a doctor's office, you're like, "How much does it cost if we go and do this?" And they're like, "Oh, we can't tell you that."
Oh, that's a whole nother debate. But so you started this morning thinking, hey, you know, this could be, based on some information you had seen earlier from the Kaiser Family Foundation on estimates of what subsidies might be for you and what the premium prices might be, you anticipated that you would be able to find something less than what you're paying for now. So you got on this morning. Just kind of take us through what your experience has been today.
Sure. Did anybody else try to sign up today? Yeah, you weren't missing anything because you couldn't. So I went on several times trying to do it. And, you know, to its credit or who knows, you know, poor web planning, I'm not sure. But they're getting all the hits that they can handle and then some. So if you go, you sign on, you can do a little bit of learn now. And if you want to learn about it through their website, then you're going to do just fine looking at all the web pages. But when it came time to click the apply now button, it was like being put on call, on hold, except you didn't have any Muzak, unfortunately. Yeah. So it took, and they wouldn't even give you a pop-up to alert you that, oh yeah, it's time, we can actually handle you now. What it said was, the website literally said, please wait here until we're ready to deal with you. So I actually didn't wait there, thank goodness for tab browsing, and occasionally check back. Finally it said, okay, you know, start the application process. And you go through, it's very easy. Give it a name, username, password. Then it asks you for security questions. Pretty standard anytime you do, you know, anything these days. Well, that part wasn't working. I don't know. Maybe we blame Firefox. Maybe we blame the federal government. I'm not sure. But it just showed blank, and you couldn't type anything in. And so get nowhere with that. And I'm like, well, you know what? I'll just type in boogers for my security answer because I'll never forget it, and I'll just do that for all three, and we'll see, you know. And that let me fill in that field. I never knew what my security questions were. I just knew the answers were going to be boogers. And so then and then you click the apply now. And then it went into the famous little swirling. And after about 5 minutes of it sitting on that screen, it came back. We're sorry, your account has not been created. Try again. You know, it has a little button, try again. Well, it doesn't just resubmit your information. You go back to the very beginning, and you start all over again. And so did that a couple of times at different points during the day, and at this juncture, I'm still not enrolled in or found anything out about how the Affordable Care Act will help me and my family at this point.
All right, so I have the same question for both of our next groups, the advocates and the journalists. Let's start with them. Is that just horrible that this is the first day that you're, I mean, we've heard these stories not just from Mark, but from, you've heard them from different people and gotten emails, you know, throughout the day. Is this bad for the ACA that this is their first day?
If you ask CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, they had a press conference this afternoon, and they said that at least they have the numbers to show that people are trying to enroll in insurance, get insurance, and that also it's the first day of a six-month process, and it's going to change, ideally, I guess, for them and for people.
When we talked to them about three this afternoon, they said 2.8 million people had accessed the website since midnight.
And that's nationally?
Yeah, that's nationally. Okay. Because the site that you're going to go to from Texas is the same in 30-something states, the states that all chose not to do their own exchanges. And so it was incredibly overloaded. I spoke to one certification counselor who helps people enroll, and he was able to sign himself on at 8:30 in the morning, and then no one else the rest of the day. And I think that was the story at a lot of these health centers that had people show up that wanted help, and even the people trying to help them couldn't get on.
Now, just to make sure I understand the numbers, 2.8 million, does that include the states that did their own exchanges, like Kentucky and others?
Well, anyone can try and get on the website.
The national site. Oh, but that's just the national
site. On the national site. It doesn't include the people that went to the
state-run sites.
State-run exchanges, yeah.
All right. So, B and Elizabeth, is this bad?
It really wasn't problematic. I mean, it was problematic, but we saw about 60 people before 4 o'clock today at our Highland Mall Enrollment Center. And people we knew would just have a lot of questions. So we spent a lot of the day answering questions, determining people's eligibility for the subsidies, going through the subsidy calculator from the Kaiser Family Foundation, and outlining the different metal plans. We had access to the HHS website that gives you the lowest cost for each of the plans. So we were able to provide people a lot of information. Some were disappointed they couldn't see the actual plans, but we have everyone's phone number and we've told them we'll call them back when the website is working. We can schedule appointments for them. So we managed to get through the day with our both enrollment centers open, and the customers were pretty happy with the information they were able to get.
So B, maybe the question is, was it a surprise that it kind of launched like this? I mean, any major website, is this what happens the first day?
I do think it was a surprise that nobody could get, I mean, I was on the road all day, and so I felt a little bit hamstrung because I was trying to do it on my phone, and I kept thinking, it's because I'm on a phone. So I started calling around and saying, have you gotten on? But I want to say, we found somebody who did, who got all the way to the point in the process where they made an account for themselves. And I asked her if she would log out and try to log back on, but she said she was busy, so she didn't have time to do that for me. But I just want to say, when we went to the Olympics in 1996, I stayed on hold for 48 hours to get tickets. So I think people who didn't get on the first day and the first, 12 hours of business are pikers, and people are ready to wait for what they want.
I guess especially if they've been waiting so far. So yes. Before we're going to let Mark go about his fatherly duties for the rest of the night here, but before we let him off stage, can y'all let him, I mean, based on the information that you've had, he's going to give you kind of his profile. Can you thumbnail what he might be expecting once he actually can log on?
All right, so family of five. Nobody has really anything wrong with them. Myself, my wife, who's, when we went on the private market, I was flabbergasted by how many questions they asked and all that, and I'm kind of curious, do y'all know, is it gonna be the same when you're going through this, when you're going to move to a different plan? Because, I mean, we had to submit medical histories, tests, and all that kind of stuff.
See, that's a great thing about this new law, is that you're not going to be asked all those health questions. The one question you will be asked is if you use tobacco. You're going to have to answer a lot of income questions. So it's going to feel more like doing a tax return than an insurance form.
Yeah, because when I was like, I'm never quitting a job with health insurance again, because it took us 2 months to get health insurance, and it was awful. It was the most invasive thing I've ever done. So we have, I went on the Kaiser website as well, and we're two people, two adults, three children, 3, 5, and 7, and it seemed like the premiums were higher, but the government subsidies maybe canceled that out, so we paid less. Is that about accurate?
Yeah, so the premium tax credit is helping you pay for that total premium amount. So what you're paying out of pocket for your premium is based on your income, and it's just a percentage of your income that you pay.
And so my one question I had as I was looking at that, and is it seemed like, is it because they don't get to take into account, do all that medical history, that the actual premium versus what we pay seems higher than what we're paying now before the subsidies? Does that make sense?
Well, it's because there's some leveling about they can't, take people who are very healthy and give them a super low premium and sock people who are not as healthy. But the other thing, more important thing, I think, for your family is every plan that you buy in the exchange will have to have some coverages. So it won't be that you will, every time you go to the doctor, have to pay, and the plan's never paying anything. There's the basic set of benefits is required for all the plans in the exchange. You can still, I think, go get a substandard plan if you don't mind paying the penalty and don't want to be in the exchange and want something super cheap. But what you're getting from going into the exchange is the quality of the product plus the subsidy to help make it affordable for your family.
All right. Let's give Mark a big hand before I pull him off stage.
Get somebody prettier up here.
All right. Ooh, it's bright up here. Let's see here. I got some more questions. Let me see if I can find them. So now we're at this day, but Veronica and Becca, you spent several weeks leading up to this doing all the coverage of the rollout. What maybe, and we'll start with Becca, what was the most interesting story that you covered during this rollout? Did you have an interesting story? Or is it, was it so just technical, all the different things that people were setting up to get ready for this day?
I think the most interesting thing that's going on right now is how the politicization of the law in Texas could impact the implementation. So if you haven't heard, Governor Perry directed the Department of Insurance to create these rules for the federal navigators. And these are people who are trained and received federal money. Well, the people who've been trained and received federal money to help people actually enroll in the exchange. And so Governor Perry wants the Department of Insurance to create additional training requirements and certification requirements. He wants them to have to report the names of the people they help enroll, which is technically against federal law because you're not allowed to document that kind of private personal information. And he's saying that this is in the name of privacy protection, that consumers are going to be putting their social security numbers and private information into these exchanges, and these people can see them, and therefore they should have, you know, more regulation to oversee this. So as you guys probably know, a lot of people aren't happy about this, and they're concerned that if the state did adopt such rules, that it would be more difficult for these people to really help people find coverage.
And now, Veronica, at the moment, that's not... We're not going to have to worry about those new rules right now. Is that right?
That's right. Becca and I spoke to Senator Watson, Kirk Watson, this earlier today, and he wrote the law that Governor Perry is basing his directive on, and it was intended to allow the state to take action and work with Washington if there were concerns, right, about consumer privacy, but it doesn't allow for the governor to just make this directive. So there'll be a process. We didn't have any, as I understand, in Travis County, but they in Harris County and wherever else in Texas that they were working, they were out, you know, doing the helping people. I guess they weren't able to sign anyone up, but answer questions. So they're moving forward, and so.
And, go ahead, B.
I just want to add something about navigators that I'm not sure, I think it's kind of getting lost in the shuffle, and that is, there's kind of a funny thing about the term navigators. There's sort of navigators with a capital N, which is the navigators program that's named in the Affordable Care Act, but the idea of navigators as people who are sort of ancillary to the health and social services areas have been around for a long time. They have a lot of different kinds of names. A lot of them are called promotoras. There are counselors, benefit counselors for people on Medicare. We have patient navigators in hospitals. So I think there's kind of a concern among social service people that this term, the kind of small N navigators, might get confused with big N navigators. And one of the most important things to remember about the Affordable Care Act is it's going to be implemented locally. People are going to have trained or, you know, in some way qualified assistance in their local community to figure out what the right plan is and to figure out how to enroll in it. And that's always been true, that people need help to navigate complex systems.
Now, Elizabeth, you're helping with counselors. Why do we not have navigators?
Well, we are certified application counselors, and we are not navigators. No one in Central Texas actually received the navigator grant, and that's turned out to be a huge blessing. So everyone in Central Texas are certified application counselors or in-person counselors. And there's an online training. It's a little less than the navigator training, but only because the navigators are obligated to do outreach and education, and there's some modules on that in the online session. But really, navigators, the counselors are providing the same services.
And you're saying that people seem to enjoy using them today? I mean, even if they couldn't get anywhere, having them there to help them understand how they could eventually come back was...
Right. So our Foundation Communities has about 70 volunteer certified application counselors who've gone through the online training. We provided supplemental training to them. And we also are using volunteers from our community tax center program. So it was sort of like by invitation only for these volunteers, because we wanted people with tax expertise, because that's really critical in completing these applications. So we are really proud of the volunteers we have who are certified application counselors. We think they've got the great skills that you need to help people with this particular enrollment application, which is, and that tax knowledge is really important.
So, you know, I would assume that everyone here knew that the exchanges were launching today and that you knew there was such a thing as the Affordable Care Act. You know, one of the things that I thought interesting in a story that Veronica did a week or so ago was, you know, she followed some people around as they were going door to door in communities where they, you know, knew that people were poor and didn't have insurance. And, there were people that had no idea what was even happening.
It's amazing. Despite all these resources, I guess it still continues to be really confusing for people. And today we had a story that I did in conjunction with the Statesman, where we spoke to people across Central Texas. So we went to Del Valle, for instance. There was a family of seven, because it's a wife and a husband and five children. And she didn't know, she knew that there'd be more affordable insurance through the marketplace, but she had no idea where to go. And you sense that desperation as a reporter when you talk to people, and they just feel really confused. And they know there's something good, but they just don't know what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, that's something that I also came across today. And one of the most interesting stories that I heard was from a community health center in Brownsville, down in South Texas, and they had 50 people come in today that wanted to get enrolled. They said the majority of these people brought pay stubs with them and income, you know, information, because they knew that something was happening, but none of them had an email address, none of the 50 people that came to this clinic. And as a result, they couldn't do anything because the exchange requires them to have an email address, and so they ended up filling out paper applications, but they're not going to know what they qualify for until they get a snail mail response from the feds.
Well, actually, you need an email address only to create the account. And on healthcare.gov, they have links to AOL, Hotmail, Gmail. So it's easy to create an account for people, and you actually don't need to use the account at all.
But in South Texas, I mean, I asked the counselor that. Why didn't you just help them sign up for an email address? And she said, you know, a lot of them were really uncomfortable with this. Some didn't even know what email was. They didn't have access to a computer, and they didn't want to sign up for something that they didn't understand, that they couldn't really use, and they were concerned. They wanted to do it in the way that they understood.
Because people actually don't ever need to use the email address. It's only to create the account. So it's okay if you never, ever check it.
I think that, yes.
Oh, one moment. Just wait 1 second.
Yeah. Nascent accounts that are just created and not used are targets for cyber criminals for identity theft. So I understand that from the ACH perspective, it's not necessary. However, I would never recommend to someone to create an account and actually not monitor it on a regular basis, I guess.
Well, and I think that just kind of goes to one thing which I think is lost in not only this, but a lot of political debates, which is that there are so many people out there that don't know what's going on with different laws, that don't know what's going on with technology, that don't know what's going on with, you know, what are they eligible for under this new law, that don't know there is even a law. So I think, you know, that's just one thing to think about as you hear different debates, especially maybe out of Washington or out of the state capitol, is that, you know, a lot of this, a lot of the concerns are focused on people that may not even have an idea of what's going on, and so outreach becomes such an important thing. And I guess that's, so now they're launched, is that the big push now from y'all, just to make sure you're, and I know you did it leading up, but you're just trying to talk to as many people as possible?
Well, there's really been almost no outreach in Central Texas around this, and one of the reasons is funding. The Navigator grant sort of had this unintended consequence that no local funders wanted to step up and provide funding until after August 15th when the Navigator grant was released, and then people sort of didn't have their act together. So there's no one knows about it because no one has really tried to educate people yet on a really large grassroots level in Central Texas.
There's a little bit maybe more to it than just the funders not wanting to get involved until they knew where the grants were, though, and that is in some of the other states. I mean, in California, Becca and I were both at a conference where we heard that California and the California Endowment are spending, I mean, orders of magnitude more money than will ever be spent in Texas on outreach because the state has the goal of getting everyone insured. They have this whole initiative called Covered California, and they, you know, talked about how by the time they're all done, they're going to have 10 uninsured people in California or something like that. But in Texas, not so. There has been kind of a concerted effort, weirdly, in the state that has the highest uninsured rate in the country, an effort to prevent people from understanding the new law, an attempt to prevent people from taking advantage of, for instance, the Medicaid expansion that we did not do, and an attempt to potentially prevent people from helping people who need help.
Now, before you say, oh, it's just, you know, Republicans versus Democrats, the state of Kentucky has its own exchange and has been pushing it very hard. Now, yes, they have a Democratic governor. They also have Rand Paul as a senator. So this is not a blue state. It appears that it is just about its buy-in from the from maybe the governor and the legislature, and without that, it can be a problem. Is that, I mean, that's what y'all have discovered in your reporting, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's important that we note that, you know, yes, our conservative leadership doesn't think that being uninsured doesn't equal, or just because you're uninsured doesn't mean you can't access care, is a lot of things that we hear from conservative leaders in this state, because you can go into an emergency room and get care anywhere. The problem with that idea is that this bill has been financed by cuts to our hospital system, and they're no longer receiving as much money to pay for uncompensated care for people that come in and don't have insurance. They're also receiving lower Medicare payments, and if we don't expand Medicaid, which we've chosen not to do, and if we also don't help people find private coverage either through the marketplace or their employers or someone else, they're just going to get a threefold payment cut from the reduction in Medicare, the reduction in hospital payments, and the reduction in the amount of people that are covered. So that puts like a huge pressure on our public hospitals and our rural hospital system, those kinds of people.
Well, before we get to some questions from the audience, I wanted to go over some fun webpage I found today, 16 top myths about the healthcare law. This was done by, by what?
Oh, fun.
Oh, yes. Oh, fun. It was done by the PolitiFact from the Austin American Statesman, PolitiFact Texas. And this is a bipartisan list, kind of. Healthcare law rations care like systems in Canada and Great Britain. That was Florida Governor Rick Scott saying something, and this is the grading system they use, saying something false. The healthcare law has death panels. That is, of course, a pants on fire from Sarah Palin. Muslims are exempt from the healthcare law. That is, again, a pants on fire. That was from a chain email, so that's just, you know, somebody sending out something. Here's one from the president. Under Obamacare, people who, quote, have a doctor they've been seeing for the last 15 or 20 years, where's the Obama one? That one's somebody else. That one was, if they've had somebody they're seeing for 15 or 20 years, they're not going to be able to keep seeing that doctor. That was from Senator Marco Rubio. That was mostly false. Here's the President Obama one. Because of Obamacare, healthcare premiums have, quote, gone up slower than at any time in the last 50 years. That is also false, although I know that argument's been used a lot. Is that an argument that you can't make yet because it's just now going into effect? So, I mean, when you hear...
Premium rates have gone down, there's just no way to link it to the Affordable Care Act. Yeah.
And you can't say that, I mean, people on the right can't say that this has been a complete failure because the rates haven't gone down quickly enough, because again, nothing really has happened quite yet. Let me see if there's a really another good one here. Oh yes, at age 76, when you most need it, you will not be eligible for cancer treatment. That was also pants on fire. And then, of course, and I wish, and I will say, we tried very hard to get a couple of small business owners up here tonight to talk a little bit about, you know, what we hear from that. That's been kind of the political volleyball on whether or not businesses are having to cut people back to part-time or lay them off or cancel, you know, their health insurance plans. And I'm not seeing that on here, but that was one of the, that was given a false but not a pants on fire, I believe. Because again, it's a matter of we just don't know yet because it hasn't gone into effect. So let me get with just one more quick question for both groups again. What's the next story you think, what's next you're going to be watching for? What's the next story you're going to pitch to Matt tomorrow morning there, Veronica?
That's a good question. I really wanted to work on something about outreach to Latinos because there are supposed to be Spanish language radio ads on Univision Radio, and just there's so many people who don't speak English, and that's something I'm interested in to see how they're, since they compose such a large percentage of the uninsured.
Becca?
So, well, tomorrow we have an interactive map coming out so that you can see what the premium rates are like in different areas of the state because they change. And what the premium rates are like depending on your age, because they also change. But something that I'm going to be looking at further is how these plans and the products in the exchange actually compare. Today was the first day that we got to look at that, and I actually didn't see it until an hour ago because the Fed stuff was so slow. But you know, each of these plans has a different premium rate, but they also have a different deductible, a different network, a different co-payments and different co-insurance rates. And so looking at the lowest premium isn't necessarily the best option for most people. And it's gonna be really complicated, especially because you know, in Austin, there are 76 plans offered in the exchange. And statewide, there's about 54 on average. So imagine if you've never had insurance before and all of a sudden you have to choose between 50 to 75 different things that are all just slightly different. And it's like, okay, do I pay $10 more this month, but $15 less every time I go to the doctor, or, you know, really looking at what the full cost of these plans is going to be for most people.
All right. How about y'all, the advocates? What's next?
We're working on creating tools for our volunteers to help people make decisions with these. It's 76 of the metal plans and then 4 catastrophic plans that people have to choose from. So we're working on tools to sort of lay out the different costs. We're doing charts that will really help people sort of have it all on one piece of paper to digest this information. And then we're also working on a tool to help people estimate their 2014 income, which is a huge challenge. Talked to a lot of people today, freelancers, and they said, you know, I have no idea what my income will be in 2014. I don't know what my income is gonna be next month. So, you know, people are being required to look into this crystal ball and predict their income for 2014. And the cost-sharing subsidies and the premium tax credit that's advanced is based on that. So we're trying to figure out how we can help people make this prediction.
Well, I want to help Veronica with her story because,
excellent.
Because you know, we're doing a lot of outreach in the faith community, and what we've gone and talked to a lot of religious leaders like bishops recently, and what they tell us is that their pastors, and especially the pastors in the Hispanic congregations, would like some more information. They have a sense that it's something that will help their congregants, but they don't have the information they need yet. So we'll be getting it for them, and we'll get you the information when we do.
Excellent, thank you.
Sure.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody. We are going to, we have a microphone somewhere. Rebecca, are you up? There she is. If you have a few questions about, you know, how to refresh the website to show that you can't get on yet, please raise your hand, and we'll be sure to answer. The one in the back there, yeah, Rebecca's working.
One second, right in the back.
I don't even know if I need the microphone. I have a question that is, it refers back to Veronica's question about outreach. My daughter asked me to ask this because she couldn't be here. How do undocumented people play into this plan? That's one. And the other one is, what about emergency room dependent people who only go to the doctor when they need? How does that work?
Well, I can take a first stab. In terms of, you have to, in order to qualify for one of these plans, you have to be here legally. And so that's, I said, from people like Elizabeth and B, I sense the frustration that they won't be helped. So. And you also can't be incarcerated, so there are just a few restrictions. And then there is a plan for people, I believe, is it up to 30 and below the catastrophic, that allows, it covers, is it just big hospitalization, but nothing much, no, much
else?
Like,
I think a couple it's preventative things.
The other one was, you touched on Medicaid, and if somebody is already covered by Medicaid, how does that work? Because Medicaid wasn't extended, so is it an option thing, like I have the option to stay with the insurance I have, I work for UT, I teach, or change if I want to? Is this the same thing for Medicaid?
So on Medicaid, if you're already on Medicaid, you should probably just stay on Medicaid, because if you qualify for Medicaid, it's because you're either really low income and or disabled and elderly, or a child. And we're not going to expand it to most poor adults. So if you're already on there, you should stay on there. If you currently have coverage but you don't like it, you can only get subsidies in the exchange if your employer doesn't pay more than 60% or more, or if the cost of the plan to you is more than 9% of your household income. So for most people, they're just going to stick with what they have, because only a few plans really meet that.
If you're on Medicaid, you couldn't get a subsidy in the exchange. So the way the exchange is organized, if your income is below a certain level, it expects you to be on Medicaid and you couldn't get any help. The issue, if I can take 2 seconds, the issue in Texas is there's a population of people who are too poor to get a subsidy in the exchange, because the exchange is going to say, you're poor enough, you should be on Medicaid. But in Texas, that won't be true, because you weren't part of, we didn't expand Medicaid yet. So those people should go to a website called TexasLeftMeOut.org.
It's a nonpartisan, non-politicized webpage.
There's another...
Catastrophic plans provide a couple, maybe up to 3 preventative checks a year, and then they have really high deductibles. They have the lowest premiums, but really high deductibles. So say you do get into a car accident, you might have to pay upwards of $6,000 to $13,000 before it would actually kick in. But it's for people that are like, I really don't want to buy a real health plan.
There's one more question right here in the back.
I went on the assumption that this is to address people living with low income, students, for example. Those are the populations they often talk about when they talk about the Affordable Care. But I recently heard that 1/3 of the U.S. population is going to be contract workers, and that's going to be up to like half of all people are going to be contractors within like the next 5 years. To what extent are those people that might be in high tech and earning big bucks part of the plan to hit, to provide this insurance?
So you're a contractor making a very good salary, but there's no insurance coming because you're not a full-time employee.
Right, you're a contractor, and for that matter, was it Red Lobster that cut back all their employees to 29 hours? That is low income, but anyway, how are they addressing? To what extent is
the ACA
a middle class, or even for that matter, upper middle class income, going to benefit and maybe enhance the use of affordable care?
Well, the good news is that they now will have this marketplace that they can shop on for insurance, so it will be much easier to purchase insurance if you don't get it through your employer. And they'll be paying full price for this, but they will at least know that they're getting 10 essential benefits. They can shop around, they can compare the different plans. So it's a lot easier for individuals now to get insurance through the marketplace.
Is it correct to say that if you are a female contractor, you're going to see a better benefit than if you're a male contractor?
Yes, because being a female is no longer a pre-existing condition.
One more question. I have a question right over here, Ben.
So years ago, when I was younger and still fertile, I became unemployed, and there was no way in Texas as a self-employed consultant to get maternity care. Is that now available through the health exchange? Can you have maternity coverage?
Yeah, that's one of the essential health benefits that all plans have to cover.
Yes!
Yeah. I will add that how good a deal the exchange is does kind of depend on your age as well. You know, right now, the way that the rates are set in the exchange is that there's basically a base rate for young people, and then they can only charge up to 3 times that for people up to the age of when they'd be qualified for Medicare. So as you get older, of course, you become a more expensive patient, and so they charge you more. But to try and level the playing field so it wasn't an exponential increase, they put this into effect. And so as a result, young people will probably be paying slightly more, but they're also going to get more benefits than they would. So, you know, you can weigh and judge whether or not that's good or bad.
Just one more thing, which is part of the question might have to do with the subsidies. And the subsidies are available to people up to 400% of poverty, but people above that can get coverage in the exchange. So even people who make a high income can go into the exchange, but not everybody gets the extra help.
Right over here, this question.
Are different providers going to be able to say yes or no to the different plans? Like I know there are providers now that say no more Medicaid, no more Medicare in my practice.
All of the plans have negotiated networks. And so like any insurance plan, if you go outside your network, you'll probably have to pay more. That's one of the biggest differences between the plans in the exchange is how skinny or big these networks are. And a lot of the ways that some of the plans have kept their rates down is by having really small networks. By the way, I also made an interactive quiz that's on the texastribune.org website. So if you don't know what the best option for you is, all of these things that I'm saying are in that quiz. You can go through and be like, this is my situation, and it'll kind of point you in the right direction without, yeah.
Now, according to this, though, if you're Muslim, you're exempt, so.
One more question.
Or old.
Right here, Ben.
Actually, I'd like to commend those of you that are on the front lines talking to consumers. Insurance is complicated. It's esoteric at best, and to know how to buy it and then ultimately how to use it is a huge undertaking to try to educate those of us that are out there in the consuming public. And my hat's off to you. Thank you.
Are there any other questions just like that? That'd be great. Anyone else?
I've got a couple more. I'm going to go across
anybody
the
about
front
journalists,
here.
Maybe?
You know, I have a question. How long do these plans last? So this seems to provide stability for people who are working, you know, freelance jobs. But once you sign up, how long does that last until you have to re-sign up?
It's just like normal insurance, if there was such a thing. It is. It's a one-year enrollment, so one of the things that'll be interesting is we have 6 months of open enrollment, which is typically more than a plan like you would get from your employer would have. You typically have like a one-month open enrollment. But after that 6 months, then the open enrollment period will be closed, and that coverage will go on from, I guess if you enrolled right this minute, if you could, it would be from January to the end of December, then you have to go through it again.
One question right here.
One thing that you guys said earlier was that it's based on a projected salary if you are a contract worker. If you don't get your contract, or if you don't project it correctly, what are the penalties with that? And then one other thing is it spelled out pretty obvious how big the network is when you're looking on the marketplace?
Well, I'll take the first question. It's important that people go in and update their account in healthcare.gov if their income changes during the year, because you don't want to get more premium tax credit than you're eligible for, or you're going to have to pay that back on your 2015 tax return. So we can make a projection, but then it needs to be updated during 2014 so that you don't end up with this payment. There are some protections. So if your actual income ends up being quite low, there are limits on how much of the premium tax credit you have to pay back. And I'll let somebody else take the network one.
I think you just answered it, but if you guess wrong on the other way, that you actually make a lot less, do you get more tax credit?
Yeah, so it's a refundable tax credit. So if you were entitled, if you purchased insurance, you have to get the insurance. But if you were entitled to more tax credit, you'll get it back as a refund on your 2015 tax return.
I haven't been able to get into the exchange, so I have no idea what it looks like there and how whether you can see the networks. The data that I looked at today showed premium rate comparisons and stuff, but it didn't show the size of their network. So I don't know how easy it is to find that information yet.
There's one more question.
I heard a piece on NPR today about health cooperatives that were something that kind of existed along with the private insurers. Will we be eligible for those, any of those choices, because we're going on the federal marketplace here in Texas? Or are they just, I mean, who gets those? Who gets access to those?
Go ahead, B. The,
maybe we should define what those are right away.
The insurance purchasing cooperatives were kind of a thing that we had that started, I guess, maybe 20 years ago in Texas, that were an alternative for people who were already facing the kind of problem that y'all have been bringing up. Their contractors, they didn't have access to employer-sponsored coverage, but they wanted to buy into a pool instead of buying on the individual market like your freelance guy there. And so there are some. There are some co-ops in Texas right now, and there's also a small business co-op where small businesses can buy affordable coverage for their employees. Likely those things will all kind of fade away if the exchange is successful, if the marketplace is successful, because what it is a mega co-op. It is all those things that people were trying to do to aggregate their costs and level their premiums across age groups and stuff. It's that for the whole country, so hopefully we won't need to have little micro co-ops anymore.
Well, the piece that I heard was about some sort of specialized co-ops that were going to specialize in chronic illness and do an especially good job of managing those, and it gave New Mexico as an example. And so I don't, because I'm familiar with those risk pools and those things, but it sounded like something different than that. And it said it'd been quiet and it hadn't been very publicized, but the reason that people could form those, and they're not-for-profit co-ops is what they are, is that they would help provide price pressure to the private insurers, and that was why they were developed.
I wish I'd heard that story. I don't even, I'm
okay.
I need to go, I'm sorry, I need to go back and listen to it. I did not hear that.
Do you remember what program it was on?
It might have been on, it was the afternoon one, After the World.
After the World. Is Here and Now After the World?
Here and Now.
Should I know?
No, it's All Things
Considered. Do I work?
Well, it was either on Here and Now or All Things Considered.
Oh, okay.
All right. Things Considered,
All
Ben.
Things Considered.
Do you not
Sorry.
Know the KUT programs?
It sounds like you just gave us the next assignment.
Another question. Oh, right here.
Hi there. We were wondering how things were going in the other states, maybe some of the ones that had independent markets. I guess, in other words, how's the front in Kentucky going?
You know, the New York Times had a story on Kentucky this past week, and at least going into the launch, they felt very confident that they were doing the things that they needed to do to get the most people signed up. They were having a lot of state-funded outreach at, you know, the places where people went. The video that the New York Times had in their story, I believe it was the New York, maybe it was the Washington Post. Anyway, the video that they had was showing the sign up for the Kentucky Healthcare Exchange booth at the state fair, which, you know, if you can imagine, I mean, can you imagine if the state of Texas had a booth at the Texas State Fair? That would be a lot of people that probably didn't even know that the healthcare exchange was happening that might wander by. But anyway, I guess we don't know yet because the federal government doesn't, you know, hasn't been able to track those numbers of what Kentucky was doing, but they felt like they were in the right position to do what they needed to do. And they expanded Medicaid as well, or
yeah,
they didn't?
I think they did, yeah. Finally.
So, you know, in that sense, they expanded Medicaid, so a lot of people would argue that they already took one good step in the right direction there.
I think the short answer is you're not going to really be able to compare the success of any of the states until 2015, because it's going to take that long to really see how the different models play out. The really good ones to watch in comparison to Texas are New Mexico, mm-hmm. Because they expanded Medicaid and they have their own exchange, and they're similar to us in a lot of ways despite their small population. Arkansas is a really interesting one to watch because they did their own type of Medicaid expansion with the feds where they're going to provide coverage to those people through their exchange.
And it wasn't the Arkansas plan, that was something that, I mean, that's similar to what Texas has asked for in the past, is that right?
Well, Texas, when we started the legislative session, floated the idea that maybe we would do something like Arkansas, but then they were like, no, we're going to do something that's the Texas solution, or the Texas alternative is what they like to call it. So a lot of the reforms that Texas wants, they want to get through a block grant, which is basically a lump sum payment that wouldn't change for 5 years, no matter how much enrollment in Medicaid changes, no matter how much inflation changes, no matter how much anything else changes, we would get the same amount every year. And for getting that block grant, Texas would have a no strings attached ability to change up the program however they wanted. This is what Governor Perry wants. So they could implement cost-sharing measures like deductibles and co-payments and things like that, and also give wellness incentives to increase obesity and diabetes and things like that. But he wants to do these kinds of reforms without expanding Medicaid before we expand Medicaid, if that is ever a possibility. And so this does not seem like a very likely situation given our current federal administration.
I think we got time. We got time for two more. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
You have mentioned several websites that are relevant. You know, will you post those on KUT.org?
I think that those websites with links will be on the page when we post this. Is that right, Rebecca? Can I just go ahead and say that we're going to do that?
Yes, you can. We will be posting this. I mean, KUTnews.org is going through some changes, but we'll just have it tomorrow.
Across the top of our webpage all day has been a banner with information. Maybe not some of the websites some that they've specifically mentioned tonight, but it has had some information on it. TexasTribune.org will have that little quiz you can take to find out who your perfect dream date is and what insurance you can get. And then the interactive map tomorrow as well.
Yeah, tomorrow around noon. It's not quite finished yet.
I mean, the
so after they
thing
yell
is,
at her to get it done, she'll
yeah.
Get it.
I think what I'll do is just
Texas.
Well, KUT.org is undergoing some changes. We will have a brand new website for you very shortly. So.
But if you go to,
I don't think it's tomorrow,
if you're on Facebook and you're on Views and Brews, we'll do a whole post with links and things like that. So.
Well, being a state service and a private foundation, I don't know that that's going to happen anytime soon. But we try.
We have time for a couple more questions. So there's one here and then a couple more.
So I'm a part-time worker, and I get the sneaking suspicion that I'm going to fit in that hole where I don't get served. And I have no idea how much income I might make next year. Should I just, like, continue to adjust my predictions up until the exchange gives me quotes and offers, or am I just out of luck if I don't guess correctly?
You mean you
You mean you won't fall in, you'll be in the place where you can't even use the exchange, or you'll be, because you would have been under Medicaid expansion, or you'll be?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
What's the low end? What's the high end? Or
so the percentage of poverty where you can start to get an exchange subsidy is 139% of poverty. And you can calculate what that is for your particular circumstances, if you're a single person or whatever. You're asking if you should gamble with it. And I guess that's an interesting question that nobody has asked me before. I don't know if anybody's asked any of y'all. But should you go ahead and estimate your income at 139% of poverty, which will max out the subsidy, and then if you guess wrong, I don't know what happens to you, because you should have been on Medicaid but not in Texas. I don't know if you'd owe the whole thing back. That's a really good question. FAQ. Yeah.
This is something I've lost sleep over for many, many nights, because we serve a lot of people who are underneath 100% or really close to it, and it's an estimate, and how do you have that conversation, but in a very honest, straightforward way, and you're not trying to sort of play the game. And I think for some people, it's a matter of, is it possible for you to clean some more houses or do some more lawns? You know, are you willing to commit to do some things to increase your income in 2014 so that this estimate is a good number? And sort of explaining to people what it will mean if they are able to do some extra work to increase their income in 2014 to push them over 100% so that they are eligible for the subsidies. And there are two types of subsidies. There's a tax credit, which is reconciled on your 2015 tax return, and there's a cost-sharing subsidies for which there's actually no reconciliation. So the real concern is with that premium tax credit, but if your income ends up being less, there's a limit to what you have to pay back. So if you fall underneath that 100%, you don't have to pay 100% back of the premium. There's a limit to how much you have to pay. Now, if your income is at that 400% and you go above it, your actual income is actually above 400%, you will have to pay back 100% of that premium tax credit. So that's the end. If someone's really close to that, they'll probably want to claim less of the premium tax credit. So in case their actual income ends up being more, they don't have to pay 100% of it back.
We've got time for just two more questions. We're going to go over a little bit. Hope that's okay.
As a small business owners, you know, by that I mean we have about 7-8 employees. One of the most frustrating things for us over the past 20 years of our, since we started our business, has been how can we provide health insurance for our employees? And so we've looked time and again, maybe 3-4 times, had people come in, and every time when we get to the bottom line, there's no way we can do it. So my question is, with this new health initiative, is there anything that we can say to our employees or anything that we can provide that can, you know, provide them with a, you know, a better access to health care insurance?
I mean, I'll say one thing, and I think other people will have things to add, but for very small employers, it's going to be really, you've all, like, a bunch of interesting new choices now. So you can get a tax credit, and it's refundable as well. Like, I don't know if you're a nonprofit or not, but you could get a tax credit for providing health insurance to your employees that you couldn't get before. And you can get it actually retroactively, if anybody's in here who that applies to, for the past 2 years. So you could end up deciding that it's actually now with the exchange and SHOP, which is the small employer part of the exchange, which won't be up and running until November 1st, you know, you'll have a place to go online to see what kind of deals you could get for your employees. With that few employees, it may very well be that, depending on how much you're paying them, the best thing you can do for them is to send them into the exchange to get individual coverage, because if they're at a pretty low salary in the first place, they will get a good subsidy. And it's nobody's expecting very small employers with low-wage employees to suddenly change what they've been doing. That's part of why the individual exchange is there in the first place.
Yeah, that's about what I was going
to say. All right.
Ditto.
All of our employees, they don't meet that in criteria of being 400% over. Their wages are higher than that, but they still are living. I mean, you can be considerably higher. We all know that than that, and still be living paycheck. Well, sometimes paycheck to paycheck. And so, is there anything that in this new health initiative that would address, you know, a business that pays beyond that ceiling?
I would look at the small employer exchange when it comes online in November, and that combined with the employer tax subsidy may make it affordable for you.
We have one last question, and we'll have to wrap it up. 1 second. Oh, okay. Well, it looks like that's pretty much all the time that we have for this evening. Ben, you want to do some final thoughts?
Thanks. thanks to Becca Aronson, Veronica Zaragovia, Bea Moorhead, Elizabeth Colvin, Mark Gwynn, who left early to get back on the exchange and see if he could find anything tonight. Thanks, as always, for coming out to Views and Brews. Remember to tip your waiter, buy another beer, and come back on...
Talk about fear.
And this is two guys in your head, right?
Exactly. And this won't be the last discussion that we do on healthcare, believe you me. In 2014, we'll be having, you know, a variety of discussions on healthcare and how things are going. So
and maybe something about the gubernatorial election.
We will.
If there is one, we don't know what's going to happen on Thursday.
Well, thank you to everyone on the panel. We really appreciate you coming out this evening. And thanks to everybody for coming out. Be sure to join us on Facebook at KUT's Views and Brews, and we hope to see you again. Have a good night.